Now call the case of 23-12568, Jose Ramon Lopez Regueiro versus American Airlines.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the court, my name is Robert Kuntz, and I represent the appellant, Jose Ramon Lopez Regueiro. The lower court erred by importing into Title III of the Cuban Liberty and Democratic Solidarity Act two non-existent preconditions. The first was a precondition that the relevant property had to have been confiscated from a U.S. national. And the second was a precondition that a claimant must have attained U.S. nationality before 12 March 1996, which we call the record date, the date that the act was signed. No language in the act itself supports the existence of these preconditions. Instead, the lower court wove them together from two thin strands, selected and misunderstood language from the findings in the act, and misapplied dicta from a decision of this court that was not and could not have been a ruling on a claim brought under the act. Since the time of the lower court's erroneous insertion of these two preconditions, on which it based the dismissal of Mr. Regueiro's claim, lower court's flawed reasoning has been serially rejected by court after court. This court, considering the case de novo, should do the same and should overturn the trial court's decision and reinstate Mr. Regueiro's claim. There is no requirement that the property confiscated have been confiscated from a United States national. The court below relied on dicta from a footnote in Glenn versus Club Med to import this imagined precondition. Nothing in the act suggests that only property taken from U.S. nationals is subject to the act, and in fact, such a reading would be inimical to the purposes of the act. The holding in Glenn, much less dicta in a footnote in Glenn, can't possibly inform any understanding of the act because the act was not before the Glenn court. Rather, Glenn had brought claims for unjust enrichment and trespass while the act was in suspension. The Glenn court disposed of those claims on the act of state grounds, which the act expressly disclaims. The same question, whether property had to be taken from a U.S. national, has come up time and time again, and it has been roundly rejected in Fernandez versus Crowley, in De Fernandez versus Crowley, in Fernandez versus CMACGM, in Central Santa Lucia, in Echeverria, in Rodriguez. Every one of those courts has said that's simply not a requirement. This imagined precondition would have rendered Title III of the Act essentially pointless because U.S. nationals who had property confiscated were not only entitled to, but required to bring those claims to the Foreign Claims Settlement Commission, and the Act, Title III of the Act, expressly excludes them from
that. Can I ask you a preliminary question before we get into the timing of when, and if I mispronounce the names, when Villeboy obtained his interest and when your client obtained his interest. You and American Airlines go back and forth on whether we should be looking at the statute in light of corporate formalities, because of course, at the end of the day, the Cuban corporation actually owns the airport. We're talking about an interest, the shares of the corporation is what we're arguing about. But do you lose if we agree with American Airlines that we should read the statute in light of corporate formalities? Because then at the end of the day, the corporation has the claim, not your client?
Your Honor, you shouldn't find that the statute has to be interpreted in terms of corporate formalities for reasons I can explain. But if you should find that, the court below made it clear that such a decision isn't for motion to dismiss anyway, that at this point, the ownership was adequately alleged. Mr. Villeboy formed a closely held company, the acronym for which is CAISA, in 52. He acquired the airport by purchase in 55. When he died intestate in 89, his inheritable interest passed to Mr. Regueiro. Mr. Regueiro was in constant possession of the stock certificates in CAISA. There is no question that the statute wasn't ever intended to be read in terms of corporate formalities.
Before you get to that,
yes, Judge.
You say it's not a motion to dismiss question, but what's the question of fact that it depends on? Sounds to me like the facts you just recited are undisputed.
I believe they are undisputed, Your Honor. And I believe that on those facts, there's a more than adequate allegation of the ownership of the claim.
Isn't that a legal question?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that that if you don't dispute the facts, that it is a legal question, and I think it's a settled legal question, that ownership by inheritance and ownership by stock is entirely sufficient.
Even if it is a legal question, if it's not one that the district court, I would say, firmly decided, would it be wiser for us to remand for the district court to consider that?
I think you can, of course, do that, Your Honor. And I think any consideration of that has to take into account, for example, the trial court in Garcia Bengochea versus Amazon, in a holding, in a finding this court did not disturb, said there's no indication in the statute's text that Congress was legislating with corporate formalities in mind. That has been resounded in Fernandez versus CMA, in the Texas case of Escalon, last week in the District of Delaware in Sierra v. TTL. What the Act says is that any property, real or personal, and an interest therein forms a claim. We know that Congress can draft an act that implicates the corporate formalities in regards to creating a statutory claim for an illegal foreign taking, for a foreign taking, because it did so in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, where it uses words like share and other entities. In contrast here, Congress used the broadly understood term claim, combined with colloquial language such as rightful owners and victims of confiscations. That's the holding, that's the finding in Garcia Bengochea in the trial court that this court left undisturbed. So yes, Your Honor, of course you could remand for that question, but if you do, it probably should be with an instruction that the Act doesn't contain those language. FSIA, it makes clear that it's dealing with the corporate formalities, but the Helms-Burton Act makes clear that it's not. With regard to that answer. The other precondition, Your Honor, I just wanted to say, in Marti versus Iberostar, this court, Judge Grant, with you writing, noted that the subject property below was confiscated from Cuban nationals who later became U.S. citizens. There's no question that you have to be a Cuban national, that you have to be a U.S. national to have your property subject to this act. Likewise, there's nothing in the Act, although the court below imported this condition, that requires attainment of that U.S. national status by the record date. The operative clause of this Act contains temporal restrictions about two things. When was the property confiscated, and when was the claim acquired? 4608.24b says, in the case of property confiscated before March 12, 1996, a U.S. national, et cetera, who acquires ownership of the claim before March 12, 1996. The Act makes it clear that any U.S. national has a claim. This court in Garcia Bengochea decided after Regero found that a claimant satisfied the requirements of the Act where the Cuban government confiscated the property after January 1st, 59, the defendants trafficked in the property, and the claimant is, in present tense, is a United States citizen.
How do you respond, though, to American Airlines' argument that in 6082A4B, which is what we're talking about,
yes, ma'am,
is of property confiscated before March 12, 1996, a United States national may not bring an action under this section on a claim to the confiscated property unless same national. Doesn't the fact that Congress chose to use unless such national instead of unless such person or unless he or she suggest that Congress intended to emphasize the requirement that the person be a United States national upon acquisition?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. This court in Garcia Bengochea defines such national as the specific person bringing the suit. Congress could have said, when it said any U.S. citizen, any U.S. national has a claim, it could have said any U.S. national who attained his nationality before March 12th. It doesn't. 608-2A4B has to be read to understand that March 12, 96 is about when was the property confiscated before that. Why? Because they don't want to create new causes of action. And when was acquisition? Before that. That sentence doesn't modify the attainment of nationalhood. We know that the act was intended. And in fact, if you read Judge Jordan's concurrence in Bengochea, the act was intended and the findings of the act state to address the fact that property was confiscated from Cubans, from United States nationals, and from Cubans who later became United States nationals. There isn't any indication in the act that that March 12th date operates as a precondition. Congress wasn't worried about people becoming citizens to bring these claims. People weren't fleeing what Kennedy called that imprisoned island just so they could come and bring these claims. Mr. Ruggiero became a citizen in 2015. He had no idea if, when, or ever the act, which had been in suspension since it was signed, would ever come out of suspension. Congress was concerned about a marketplace of claims. It didn't want claims to be bought and sold. And so it said, if you haven't got your claim by the time the act is signed by President Clinton on March 12th, you don't have a claim. But the attainment of nation of U.S. nationality isn't the important issue. And Garcia Bengochea, this court's decision, deals with nationality in the present tense. Is the claimant clearly must be a United States national, but there's no suggestion that that has to happen a day before the claim is brought, or in Mr. Ruggiero's case, many years before.
Do you agree with Judge Jordan's concurrence that probably Congress meant to or should have provided for claims that arise after that date via inheritance rather than via these other means?
I think Judge Jordan's concurrence couldn't be more right, and we all could wish that Congress had written things differently than it did. We're fortunate in our case that Mr. Ruggiero's claim was attained well before the record date. There simply isn't a question. Leaving aside the corporate formality issues that Judge Branch raised, the timing of it, it's 1989, and he had the stock from the mid-50s. So for those who do acquire their claims by inheritance after the date, I think that Congress did mean that. I think that they're preserved by equitable tolling, assuming that they've pled it. But I don't think we need that here because the claim was acquired well before the record date. And I see that I'm into my time. Thank you, Judge.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The simplest way to resolve this case is to affirm on the ground that Ruggiero was not a U.S. national as of March 12, 1996, the date of enactment of the Helms-Burton Act. The text and context of Section 6082A4B show that Congress meant to create both a nationality and ownership requirement as of the date of enactment. The basic point on the text is that U.S. national and such national are not meaningless placeholders. They're operative words of the statute. United States national and person are both defined terms in this statute. And Congress chose to say U.S. national instead of person. Congress also chose to say such national acquires rather than such person acquired. Court should respect those choices.
Why though, I'm looking at the statute, a United States national, right? That is what Mr. Ruggiero is today, right?
Correct.
Why, when the text of the statute later says such national, why isn't that just referring back to him today as opposed to him, 30 years ago?
Well, because the second half of the sentence imposes a new time requirement. So it says such national, then it says acquires, then it says before March 12, 1996.
And that right means, context, I think that would mean that you would have to also be right that you had to be a U.S. national in the first place when the property was taken by Cuba, right? Because it doesn't make sense that it would apply to people who were Cuban nationals living in Cuba when the property was confiscated and then later became U.S. nationals. But you'd have a different requirement for someone who acquired the property later. Do you see what I'm saying? I don't see why the statute wouldn't treat those two context is parallel.
I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question exactly, but I'll say that it, our argument does not depend on the second point about property confiscated from Cuban nationals. So suppose a property is confiscated from a U.S. national, that U.S. national transfers the claim to a Cuban national or some other national. That's what happened in Garcia Bengochea, the 11th Circuit case, where the property was confiscated from U.S. national. It was then transferred to a Costa Rican national and then transferred back to U.S. national. So in that circumstance, 8-4B would apply, and Congress could very well have been concerned about those sorts of transfers, given that 35 years had passed since 1959 when the property was, when all this happened.
I guess what I'm saying is that Mr. Ruggiero is similarly situated when he acquired the property, right? He had at least arguably an ownership interest in the property when his father passed. He was not a U.S. national on that date. And so he was similarly situated to a person living in Cuba at the time that their property was acquired. They were not a U.S. national on that date. And then when they acquired the property, and then they subsequently became a U.S. national, just like Mr. Ruggiero subsequently became a U.S. national. I'm having a hard time understanding why those two categories of people would be treated differently.
Well, one thing we can point to is Congress's own stated purpose in the conference report, where it wanted to freeze ownership and nationality as of the date of enactment in order to prevent foreign nationals with claims to try to get those claims into the hands of U.S. nationals. And if you're a foreign national, there's two ways to do that. You can transfer the claim to U.S. national, or you can relocate. And Congress spelled out both of those scenarios in the conference report in two consecutive sentences. The first sentence talks about transfers, and the next sentence, which my friend's reply brief ignores and pretends it doesn't exist, talks about, it says, persons who would relocate. The cause of action should not be available to persons who would relocate to the United States. And it's talking about this specific provision. So that's what Congress wanted to do, is create a freeze date as of the date of enactment for both nationality and ownership. And further confirmation of that comes from two other provisions in the statute, where Congress created the same limit based on nationality, ownership, as of the date of enactment. So Congress was well aware of this coincidence of attributes. Those other provisions.
Why would Congress be explicit about the date of ownership, though, and use all these implied ways to get to date of becoming a U.S. national?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's very express. I think such national acquires ownership of the claim before March 12th, 1996, is direct and express. And I think under Ruggiero's reading of this provision, person and U.S. national are fully interchangeable and had acquired. It makes no difference. The statute could say person had acquired and would make absolutely no difference. That's not a way to read a statute.
Just grammatically, I mean, I don't see why Congress would have assumed that they needed to say person when referring back to the U.S. national in order to make that clear.
Well, I can make one additional point is, the only reason to say U.S. national in A4B at all is to create this requirement before the date of enactment, because we already know, based on the cause of action itself up in Section A1, that the plaintiff must be a U.S. national at the time of filing suit. So it's the only reason to put it in here is to do exactly what we're saying it does. And those are all the pieces of, I've run through all the pieces of context that show that our reading is correct. In this situation, the best reading of the statute is what we're saying based on all the pieces that I've just run through.
In Section 602.312b, you argue that that supports your argument as far as the plaintiff must be a national before the March date. But that section says that the term property does not include real property used for residential purposes. And here's the key language: unless, as of March 12, 1996, the claim to the property is held by a United States national. By articulating that requirement for residential property, doesn't that mean that other property is not subject to that requirement?
No, Your Honor, because the last part of that requires that the claim be certified. So it has to be held by a U.S. national and certified by the Foreign Claims Settlement Commission.
But where Congress wanted to say that the claim had to be held by a United States national as of that date, it said it clearly.
Well, if you line up all three of these provisions, they're saying materially the same thing. One says the claim to the property is held by a U.S. national. The other says the claim to which is owned by a U.S. national. That's Section 6033. And then A4B says such national acquires ownership. Those are materially the same language. And again, those are the points of context. If I may, I'll move to the argument that, actually, what I'd like to say is two quick points on the corporate formalities argument. There is no factual dispute here. Paragraphs 28 of the complaint, 43 of the complaint allege ownership through CAISA. That's the factual issue. The district court did firmly decide this, and there's no basis for a remand on this issue. And I'll just point the court to the Dole Foods case, which we cite in our brief, which explains how to analyze direct and indirect corporate ownership in a statute like this. I'll move on to the problem, if I may, that the property was confiscated from a Cuban national. So page 14 of the reply brief should be dispositive on this issue, and I'll explain why. The cause of action in this statute requires a plaintiff to own the claim to confiscated property. A claim to confiscated property is a right to compensation against the government for a taking. For a claim against the government to exist, there must be a law that creates it. In the U.S., for example, the Fifth Amendment Takings Clause creates a right to compensation against the government the moment the government takes someone's property. But without the Fifth Amendment, no claim would exist. Without the Takings Clause, ownership of the underlying property itself, of its own force, would not create a claim against the government. And here, Ruggiero has pointed to no law that creates a claim to confiscated property when the Cuban government allegedly confiscated property from a Cuban national in Cuba. And what is his response to this? He first concedes that the Helms-Burton Act does not itself create claims to confiscated property. He says this emphatically twice, page 13 of the reply and then page 14 of the reply. And then in a critical paragraph on page 14 of the reply, he asserts without citation and without explanation in a single sentence that ownership of the underlying property itself of its own force gives rise to a claim against the Cuban government for confiscated property. There's a reason there's no citation in that paragraph on page 14. It's because there's no authority for it in the history of takings law. Under all authority that we're aware of, claims against the government do not arise unless created by law. Now, it's Ruggiero's burden to plead a legally viable claim for relief here. And that paragraph on page 14 is woefully inadequate. Now, I'll add that it makes sense that property confiscated from Cuban nationals would not create claims to confiscated property when you look at the statutory findings, where Congress stated over and over again that the concern here was about property confiscated from Cuban nationals. And all of this shows that that Ruggiero's lead argument about certified and uncertified claims is just beside the point. We've shown in our brief that there's still room under our interpretation for uncertified claims. And none of the provisions about uncertified claims say anything about where claims to confiscated property come from.
Why wouldn't Title III have contained the explicit limitation that Title V contains if the statute intended to apply only to those who were U.S. nationals at the time property was confiscated?
Well, Your Honor, I can say what Congress did say in the statute, and it said that the plaintiff must own a claim to confiscated property. And then it backed it up with statutory findings that repeated over and over again the concern was about property confiscated from U.S. nationals. So the things that are crystal clear in the statute is that a plaintiff must own a claim to confiscated property. And when you look at what a claim is, a claim is a right against the government. This is clear from the Foreign Claims Settlement Act, the International Claims Settlement Act. This is what the International Claims Settlement Act says about claims to confiscated property. This is section 1643B of the Claims Settlement Act. And it says the commission, that's the Foreign Claims Settlement Commission, shall receive and determine the amount and validity of claims by nationals of the United States against the government of Cuba. So we know what a claim is a claim against the government.
Right. But then the very next section, 1643CA, says a claim shall not be considered under section 1643BA of this title unless the property on which the claim was based was owned wholly or partially, directly or indirectly by a national of the United States on the date of the loss. I mean, that's pretty explicit. And it's clear that Congress was reading and considering Title V when it was drafting Title III. I can't understand why, if that limit was part of what Congress was thinking, they wouldn't include a similar specific limitation.
Well, Your Honor, I think the response is Congress was legislating against the backdrop of takings law. And so when Congress says the plaintiff must own a claim to confiscated property, it incorporates this understanding.
Was takings law different when the first statute was passed? I don't think so.
No, Your Honor. So I'll say this. If that contrast makes a difference, if you think that the contrast in this place in the Claim Settlement Act is dispositive, then I would take the court over to the corporate formalities argument, where there is another contrast between the Claim Settlement Act and the Helms-Burton Act. The Claim Settlement Act there refers to, in that same section that you're referring to, talks about direct and indirect property interests and says that the Foreign Claims Settlement Commission can certify those types of claims. The Helms-Burton Act, the definition of property, nowhere does the Helms-Burton Act talk about direct and indirect ownership. And if you're going to draw a contrast between those, that's where to drive. In both situations, then we win on the CAISA corporate ownership argument. Again, I would point the court to the Dole Foods case on that issue, which explains how to address and analyze direct and indirect corporate ownership. And what it did is it looked at the statute at issue. That statute didn't talk about direct and indirect ownership. Then it looked at several other statutes where Congress had used that language of direct and indirect ownership.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked opposing counsel. If we decide that we should read the statute in light of corporate formalities, do you win?
Yes. Yes, we do, as we've explained in our brief. And the reason is that Ruggiero owns, assuming our other arguments are incorrect, at best, Ruggiero owns a claim to CAISA. CAISA owns a claim to the airport, and the airport is the property that was trafficked in, not CAISA. And so for that reason, we win on that issue. And again, I'll just say there's no factual dispute on that, as we pointed out here today. The district court ruled on it, and as I've explained here today, the district court is incorrect. And I think if the contrast between the Claims Settlement Act and the Helms-Burton Act is what's driving the court's decision, then it should be consistent with the two arguments, the CAISA argument, the corporate formalities argument, and the confiscation from a Cuban national argument, because there are contrasts in both situations. And what my friend wants to do in his brief and asks in his brief is to draw different contrasts in two different places. In where it contrasts on the confiscated from a Cuban national, he says, oh, that's a huge contrast and we should read them differently. When it comes to corporate formalities, he says, incorporate the Claim Settlement Act into the Helms-Burton Act rather than drawing a contrast. And if there are no further questions, I'll submit and ask the court to affirm.
Let's talk about definitions. Because the Act says that any U.S. national has a claim, can bring a claim under Title III. And then it defines a United States national at 602315 as any United States citizen. There isn't a question that Mr. Ruggiero was a United States citizen. What is happening here is that American Airlines is attempting to insert a domestic takings rule argument, as it did in its brief. This is not a claim against a sovereign. The Act expressly disclaims the active state doctrine. There's no language that applies the domestic takings rule. The domestic taking rule is meant to bar claims against foreign sovereigns. This is a claim against a U.S. company. This is not a claim for a confiscation. This is a claim for trafficking in the confiscated property as described in the Act. The Helms-Burton Act, it's unsurprising that it doesn't contain that language. Congress is very careful when it created, for example, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which has great implications with regard to comedy since it creates a statutory claim against a foreign sovereign. Congress was very careful to say, you have to make sure that you satisfy all of this. But there's no requirement in Title III that the confiscated property even have been taken in violation of any international law, because this is not a claim against a sovereign. Fernandez versus CGM lays it very clearly. Defendant's invocation of the domestic's taking rule is unpersuasive and in fact demonstrates why Helms-Burton Act does not require violation of international law. That was essentially the same finding in, I will now mangle this, Successores de Don Carlos Nunez, and in Sierra Tree Figura, again, last week in the District of Delaware. As for whether corporate formalities apply, I've explained why I think they don't. But even if they did, for example, in Escalon in the Southern District of Texas, it's clear that the interest that claimant owned there by inheritance and by stock ownership, just like Mr. Ruggiero, is a claim in the meaning of Title III of Helms-Burton. This is not a claim against the Cuban government because I owned the property and you took it from me and give it back. This is a claim against a private entity, American Airlines, because you knew the property was confiscated, you knew you were subject to liability for trafficking in it, and you